Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, November 7th, 2024. I'm Anthony Pastore. Thank you for joining us. Today, I am joined by my chief investment office colleagues, Kurt Ryman, the head of fixed income and the Election Watch lead, Brad Ball, financial strategist, Kevin Dineen, technology and telecom strategist, and Jay Dobson, energy and utilities strategist. So we have quite a group of people here in the room to answer a lot of my burning questions, and I'm sure many of yours, which means we are going to open it up to you, our live audience, a little bit later in the show. But for now, you can click that Ask a Question button that is right there on your screen to engage with the panel during today's discussion. So make sure to click that. All right, so let's get started. Kurt, I thought a couple of days ago we might be sitting here wondering who was going to be the next president, but that answer came a lot more quickly than I think many, many of us had anticipated. So here we are. We know President-elect Trump is going to be sitting in the White House next year. We did a live stream yesterday with a couple of our other colleagues talking about the election outcome and most importantly, the impact on the financial market. So I guess the question is, as we dive deeper in, and especially as we look from a sector perspective, which is why we have this panel put together today, what's your assessment of President-elect Trump's key legislative and administrative kind of policies that he'll be putting into place?
Sure. So I think we have to first start with tariffs and trade policy and generally the broader rubric of national industrial policy that has been a hallmark for the last 8 years. That's going to continue. Congress has a bipartisan view with respect to a tough stance on China, but also export controls, reviews of outbound and inbound investment activity. And we can expect Trump to raise the temperature on this with tariffs targeted specifically towards China, but also not unlikely to hit a number of other countries. He will define what universal means. He has broad authority to make these decisions, does not require Congress to get involved. So I think that's the first point of departure. Now, he also will be checking back on the impact this has on inflation because voters went to the poll and they voted on the economy, they voted on inflation. So getting a symbolic victory or some kind of an achievement might be just enough to start rolling those back. Mm-hmm. Deregulation is another one that we will want to really focus on, especially today. But what I think is partly missing here is not just that Trump will deregulate, but he's also coming into office just after this past summer when the Supreme Court reversed a longstanding statute that had given the executive branch broad remit to interpret statutes the way they thought. It's known as Chevron deference. But that's no longer applying. So the Supreme Court has already said that they intend to take back some of this interpretation of legislation. So we were in a deregulatory regime anyway, and Trump is going to likely extend that. Mm-hmm. Those are the two larger areas. Of course, fiscal policy will also matter. As far as the kind of setup for today's discussion, I think those are the two big ones. On geopolitics, I would say, just kind of beyond the tariff story, we can expect Trump to try to make some additional appeals in the Middle East to tighten the screws on Iranian oil output, also to try to make some headway in ending the war in Ukraine. Those are, they've been key geopolitical flashpoints over the past 4 years. He will bring his own personnel and administration to bear there.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. The burning question for most out there right now, including myself, is about the House. The Senate has gone to the Republicans with a 51 majority, but the House is still kind of up for grabs, or undecided, I guess, is the more to the point, without a majority being reached yet. It's a significant outcome because if the GOP gets it, they'll have all three branches of government. How significant is this outcome, do you think, to policy or to the way the markets might react to if it was a mixed Congress?
Yeah, we don't know one of the most consequential outcomes still, and that's the House. So John was saying yesterday that the president swept all seven swing states, that we had gains from Republican voting from 2020, that they picked up seats in the Senate. you know, we're now at 52. Do they get one or two more? That's important because there are a couple moderate senators that could make it more difficult for some of the cabinet appointments and some of the other legislation. So getting another seat or another two seats, that's Nevada and Arizona, mm-hmm. got to be looking out for that. But the House, I mean, that's crucial in terms of the legislative sort of firewall that maybe the Democrats would want to achieve here. If you think about a red sweep, though, we don't want to think of this as a blank check on fiscal policy at all. The cost of just extending the personal tax cuts, which is a key priority of the administration and many members of Congress, is already a $3 to $4 trillion price tag. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be hard to add additional items like corporate tax cuts or other exemptions on income. They'll try. They can maybe toy around with the idea of perhaps only going for a couple of years on the personal income tax cuts, and then they have more wiggle room on other items, but we'll see. But the Republican sweep gives more, it kind of smooths the pathway for fiscal policy. If it's a Democratic House, then there's got to be much more horse trading and conversations about what will pass and what won't. And it also, on sort of just broader legislative discussions, we have to keep in mind legislation is still going to require that 60-vote threshold to avoid the filibuster mm-hmm. in the Senate. Republicans don't have that. So anything on tax and spending is likely going to have to go through, you know, continuing resolutions, also the likely reconciliation. So these congressional processes for moving things along are going to have to require some, you know, coming together, meeting right. of the minds.
Right. Yeah, and obviously we'll be keeping an eye on that story as it might impact the way markets kind of right. think about this administration coming in. If there is going to be a Democratic-led House, it could change some of the things that we're going to talk about here with the rest of the crew. So thanks, Kurt. Stick around. I know we're going to get some questions from the audience for you. Brad Ball, let me bring you in. Now, we're talking here about the financial side. And if you look at what happened yesterday's markets, across the board, most sectors were just, you know, really, really rallying on the Trump trade. Or maybe it could be the fact that it was a certain election on Tuesday night. Or also it could be just what we're talking about that Kurt is saying. There are some fiscal policies that we know that could potentially happen with President Trump and his administration that could impact some of these sectors in a positive way. So with especially the banking index, because the banking index yesterday was up something like 6.2%, down a little bit today. But do you think it's too late to get in here for investors? You know, should they maybe wait for the dust to settle, or is there still room to run given the rally that we saw yesterday?
Well, thank you. I think the direct answer is that it's always smart to take a cautious and gradual approach. Actually, after significant, like we said yesterday, to your point, the S&P U.S. financials rose a little over 6% yesterday versus the S&P 500, 2.5%. And the bank index rose 10.7%, again, versus the S&P up just 2.5%. So we saw significant outperformance. And I think there's really three main reasons why financials responded positively to Trump's success on Tuesday night. The first is growth policies, expectations that taxes will be lower than would have been the case otherwise. There is a outlook that you could see an improvement in loan demand. You could see a pickup in loan growth overall, client engagement, broadly speaking, where financial companies are intermediating transactions between lenders and borrowers. And credit quality, generally speaking, would be expected to be better in a growth environment. Second is regulatory. As Kurt mentioned, we would expect to see a somewhat softer regulatory touch for U.S. financials. In particular, you could see that for U.S. banks, and it's the mid-sized regional banks to relatively smaller institutions that would be big beneficiaries of a pendulum swing back in terms of the regulatory environment. I think about regulations along two lines. First, there's the cost of compliance, which has been going up over the past 4 years under the Biden administration. That could be expected to be softened somewhat. And the second is the cost of capital. We're currently, the Fed and the other regulators are currently reviewing capital adequacy guidelines for the big banks. The proposal that came out a year ago was actually fairly harsh, and you could expect that the new capital adequacy under a Trump administration would be somewhat softened, if not just delayed into the future. So the combination of those two, lower compliant capital, could help improve earnings growth and profitability for the industry. We would expect to see banks be more aggressive in share repurchases in a less capital restrictive regime, less capital restrictive environment, which would be expected. And then the third point of all this is the likelihood of M&A. There's currently 4,300 chartered U.S. banks. That's excess capacity. There needs to be consolidation in the banking industry. And so just M&A among midsize and small banks would be a positive. And you could expect a Trump administration and the regulators that he appoints would take a somewhat softer approach to consolidation relative to the Biden administration. And frankly, M&A is good for banking businesses. So the big Wall Street banks that advise on M&A would be helped by an increase in mergers and acquisitions. And you would also expect to see potentially more sponsor-driven transactions. The private equity sponsors that are sitting on significant amounts of excess capital and cash are looking to transactions. Those transactions could be financed by the banking industry. They could be advised by the big Wall Street. So that would be a positive tailwind as well. So if you put those three things together, fundamentals, regulatory, and an M&A backdrop, they all look pretty good under a new Trump administration.
Yeah, so it sounds like your outlook then, Brad, is pretty positive for the sector. Is that right?
Positive. I think that the leaning going forward will be on upside earnings estimates. It's an improved profitability because of the backdrop that I just mentioned. Of course, the risks that Kurt mentioned about the economy, if there are increased tariff activities and you do see a little more inflation, if rates remain a little bit higher, those are risks that we can stick in. But broader backdrop, increasing loan demand, increasing M&A activity, better credit quality overall, those are all good things for the banking sector and the financial sector more broadly.
Great. Thank you, Brad. And again, stick around. We're getting some questions into the studio, so we'll keep you around for some banking questions that might come in. Kevin, Deneen, let me bring you in. So good to see you. What does a Trump victory mean for the semiconductor industry? You know, you look at something like the Chips and Science Act of that was passed a couple of years ago. And as far as export control yeah. restrictions, how does that play into this new Trump administration that's coming in?
Yeah, so I think export controls, I don't know that there's much incremental impact because I think the notion of export controls around semiconductor technology and other technology shipments to China, I think that is one of the few areas that probably has bipartisan, bicameral support. So I think those export controls would have been be put in place going forward, no matter who was in office. I think on semiconductors and the CHIPS Act, we've heard President-elect Trump talk about wanting to walk back some of the CHIPS Act provisions, some of the funding. He termed it sort of not such a great deal for the U.S. House Speaker Johnson sort of echoed that, but then also but he actually walked back some of the comments. So I think that it touches on what Kurt mentioned earlier, national industrial policy. I think that there's a broad-based understanding in D.C. that technology is a key driver of economic growth. It's a key driver of competitiveness at the regional level. Technology is underpinned by semiconductors, and I think there will be more likely than not ongoing support for the semiconductor industry.
Right. And just to the Chips and Science Act is essentially something that keeps semiconductor jobs in the United States, essentially, right?
Right. So it was a package of about $52 billion in subsidies and loan packages that was targeted to bring semiconductor manufacturing capability back to the U.S.
Right. Okay. There's another sort of conversation that's related to Section 230, which relates to internet companies. And I mean, a simplified definition, it protects Americans' freedom of expression online. But if we do get, say, a red sweep, if Congress does go fully on the GOP side. What does it mean for that Section 230 and internet companies?
Yeah, so Section 230 is really the safe harbor that allows internet companies to not be held liable for content posted on their platforms, but then also gives them the ability to take down content for whatever reason they see fit. Mm. And I think this has always been an area that both Democrats and Republicans have issues with, but they see the same problem from exactly the opposite side of the spectrum. Democrats tend to think that there is too much hate speech or objectionable speech, and Republicans tend to think that there's too much censorship. So this really would require legislative reform. You can't do this through regulatory action, and you probably do need a clean sweep with one party controlling both houses of Congress as well as the executive branch. So we're going to have to wait to see how the Republican races shake out. Mm-hmm. The congressional races shake out. But it's something that we're going to have to watch closely. I think there's some other nuances here, too. I think they want to be very careful about over-regulating some of the most successful companies in the U.S.
I mean, with over-regulation, potentially it could hit on the investing side, essentially.
Right.
I mean, if we do see a red sweep.
Right, because a lot of these leading social platforms, leading technology companies, they're not just excelling at their own core businesses. They're also doing very important work around AI.
That's right. Okay, great. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, stick around. Lots of questions coming in. So, Jay Dobson, on the energy side, oil's down a little bit today. When I last checked, it was down about 30 cents or so. It's 71 and change a barrel. But as you were talking about yesterday, a lot of the energy companies were up significantly on the, kind of the expectation that a Trump presidency, Trump 2.0, will be better for fossil fuels, et cetera. So what should we expect in the energy outlook once President-elect Trump comes back into office and starts legislating?
Yeah, I think it's an important question, Anthony, because contrary to you know, sort of the reaction yesterday, I think it's fair to say it's a fairly neutral outlook for, you know, energy equities, at least here in the U.S., and I would say for, you know, oil production, maybe slightly more positive for natural gas production, but I'll get to that in a moment. I think, to be clear, you know, as Kurt pointed out, you know, regulation starts to decline, so I think that's an important element to keep in mind. But I think when you sort of get through all of it, it really, global macro is going to trump, you know, public policy. And what I mean there is when we look around the world, we've got ample supplies, spare capacity for oil. So there's really not a need to see increase in production here in the U.S. And when you talk to a number of the energy companies, they're not planning on any increase in oil production. So I think you've got a pretty neutral view of energy equities. That's certainly the place we've been. You know, regulation, lower regulation does help at the margin, but, you know, sort of global macro will be far more important. You know, to be sure, we'll see higher demand for natural gas. I think that will be helpful, but that was pretty much already baked in. We'll see things like the LNG pause going away, maybe some siting permit reform, which would be really helpful. But I think at the end of the day, you know, contrary to what we saw yesterday, I would argue that the impact on U.S. energy equities is pretty limited in this environment.
Great. And what about on the renewable side and the sort of the clean energy side? I think there's a lot of assumptions out there that a Trump presidency will be negative for that area of the energy market. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very similar answer. You know, when we look at you know, sort of what I'll call old energy or fossil fuels, you know, I think there's a perception that it's going to be really good. And when you look to renewables, people think it's really bad. And I think probably the market is over, you know, estimating risks in renewables. Certainly there is some risk. We'll see what happens with the House majority, but, you know, some risk at the margin to, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure and Jobs Act. But I think when you really get to the brass tacks, there's probably not a ton of risk there for renewables. I think the biggest issue is if we do see some slight moderation of growth in renewables, this is a much younger industry than the, you know, sort of old energy industry. So we really need to look at the companies that have really strong balance sheets, have really strong competitive advantages. But I would say within the sort of grouping of those companies, I expect they're going to do just fine over the next 4 years. You know, renewables are supported by the economics of, you know, wind and solar as a starter. And I think we're going to continue to see development there.
Right. So your mid to long term view hasn't really changed all that much at this point.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I think the last Trump administration, 2016 to 2020, would, you know, inform you of that and would, you know, basically suggest what I'm saying is correct. And I think the only other thing to add on is just we have higher demand growth outside of oil in natural gas and electricity. We have higher demand growth, which probably says, you know, it's more likely to be, you know, sort of supportive and a sort of neutral reaction, at least on the oil side.
Great.
You know, looking forward.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Okay, terrific. So in the meantime, we want to encourage you to ask questions. You can click the Ask a Question button right on the website where you're watching this particular video. While we're waiting for questions to come in, Kurt, you also wear the head of fixed income hat besides the Election Watch lead. So I wanted to ask you, we've got, you know, Jay Powell and the Fed are literally ready to release the statement today on what they're going to do with interest rates. Our expectation is that there will be another 50 basis points cut before the end of the year, maybe 25 today. But given that outlook and then the 100 basis points we're expecting next year, and by we, I mean CIO and our economist, Brian Rose, how does that impact your thoughts on rates and the overall fixed income markets going forward?
Right, so there's a Fed meeting. You know,
yeah, there's that little thing that's happening in a little while, like less than an hour.
Exactly. Yeah. So the bond market is has repriced for growth, for inflation, for deficits. Right, this run up 80 basis point move from 360 to, you know, just below 4.5 has been a bunch of factors. But our core message since the middle of September. Leslie Falconio has been stressing this point, was back when rates were below 4%, touching on 360, the value in the back end of the curve was just not there. And so we've been taking more of an approach of, yeah, get yield in the bond market. Compared to other elections, you know, back in 2016 or 2020, we didn't have the yields we have today.
That's right.
So don't go too far out on your interest rate risk, but do go out. Take the opportunity to lock in some of these yields in, say, the five-year part of the curve, because, as you point out, rates on the very front end are not going to be where they are in a year and a half or so when these rate cuts come in. So the point is it is time still to take advantage of yield quality fixed income, corporate bonds, tight spreads, but you know, this election outcome doesn't change that, or even agency MBS. The volatility coming into the election around rates was very high. That tends to be a penalty for agency MBS. But when volatility comes back down again, then you start getting rewarded. So there are opportunities in fixed income. We're not ready to go yet fully long duration, but we're looking. I mean, we're getting ready at these levels to start thinking about that next opportunity in the bond market.
Great. Thank you, Kurt.
Sure.
Question coming in here. Looks like, Jay, it's for you. Talking about geopolitics, how could that impact your outlook for energy equities? I'm assuming the question relates to the conflicts that are happening in the Middle East and, you know, Russia, Ukraine, and, you know, President-elect Trump sort of promised to try and figure out how to solve these conflicts. How does that impact your outlook for energy?
Yeah, I mean, Kurt mentioned, you know, early on, you know, what President Trump may or may not do on, you know, Iranian sanctions and the impact on oil supply there. You know, obviously you have a conflict brewing between Israel and Iran and what could be the impact there. And then, of course, you have Ukraine, Russia. That wouldn't add incremental barrels back. But I do think the sort of first derivative would be, you know, if these sanctions come back, you know, how much supply would they take off the market from, you know, Iranian exports? I think there, again, you fall back on what I mentioned in my earlier comments, and that is we have ample supply. You know, Saudi Arabia right now and OPEC Plus is looking to bring back supply. They had to postpone that because the market wasn't strong enough to support it in early November for the December month, and they pushed that out to year end. But I think I still fall back on the idea there's ample spare capacity right now. So though we will be watching that in Venezuela as well, it's not something that I think really does tip me in favor. In fact, I would go as far, our hypothesis would be, if we saw a big run-up in oil prices on the back of something like this, and you saw big strength in energy equities, I might be willing to lighten in the face of that. Again, a hypothesis we'd want to reevaluate, but definitely something to keep in mind.
Great. Thank you, Jay. Brad, I'm going to bring you in. I've got an question for you. Just kind of asking, you know, and I sort of alluded to this in one of my questions for you is, now that, you know, we've seen this big, you know, move up in a lot of the banking names, particularly the index, would you add to positions given where we were yesterday and today?
Yeah, your question was, should we wait for the dust to settle? And my gut is that would make sense seeing a little dust settling today with the bank subsector down maybe two and a half percent. So we're getting back some of yesterday's outperformance already. I would always advise folks to be selective, identify the names within U.S. financials that are most levered to the things I described earlier, which include fundamental strengths, loan growth, increasing loan demand is key, and you can see that across the regional bank sector. Regulatory relief, you can see relief across regional banks, as well as some of the special finance, super finance companies, and M&A. You could see advisors, the M&A boutiques, as well as the larger investment banks on Wall Street, all benefiting. And we do need dollars within the banking industry, in which case you would expect the small and mid-sized banks to perform those things. I'd be selective after the big run-up yesterday. It was really a very extraordinary move in the group. But I still think that the wind is at our backs going into next year. And as I mentioned earlier, Anthony, we're going to be focused on earnings per share upgrades, increases going into 2025 and 2026, as well as the possibility for profitability improvement. Those two things could help both on the PE and the price to tangible book value, which are the key valuation metrics that we focus on for the sector.
Great. Thank you, Brad. And thank you for the question from the audience. Kevin, another question coming in. This one's for you. Now that Trump has won the presidency, do you expect any headwinds for tech if trade tensions increase? Obviously, with tariffs, it poses a little bit of maybe an additional headwind risk potentially for the tech sector. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's certainly something we have to keep an eye on. And I think if we do get tariffs, I think the parts of technology that are most directly impacted would be hardware and then semiconductors, because obviously there's a lot of semiconductor content in hardware. I think, though, we have to be careful about jumping to too strong conclusions, because as we've seen in the past, when there were tariffs put on, there were an awful lot of exemptions. So we have to wait and see. I also think that there's maybe a lesser appreciated impact of tariffs potentially, in that you could see sort of a reaction against U.S. companies selling hardware products into mostly consumer electronics, mm-hmm. smartphones, things like that, into China. There could just be sort of a nationalist or some sort of a reaction on that front. So we have to be careful around tariffs. We also have to be careful about jumping to conclusions too soon around tariffs.
Right. Yeah, and we don't even know exactly what the Trump administration will do. We heard what we heard on the campaign trail, but obviously there's a lot that could change between this day and, you know, January when he is inaugurated in his first 100 days, depending on what that looks like. Thank you, Kevin. Jay, here's another question coming in for you. The risk of a GOP rollback of the IRA energy efficiency tax credits and the direct payments to nonprofits through the IRS. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I'd say...
By the way, I should have not used the acronym. The Inflation Reduction Act, IRA.
So, yes, yeah. Exactly. So Inflation Reduction Act. And as I said, you know, I don't see a ton of risk there. We still need to figure out where the House is, so how much, you know, sort of momentum we're going to have behind that. You know, there are these smaller elements like energy efficiency, like EV tax credits, that I think could get pulled back. Some of those things can be done with, you know, sort of executive authority. Mm-hmm. But I think at the end of the day, there's still a reasonably small amount of risk there. Again, you know, some of these energy efficiency EVs, you know, you're talking here about direct payment for nonprofits. You know, I think some of those, maybe some that have greater risk. And the question is, are they taken away fully or are they just scaled back? But when I think of the bigger things that are really driving renewables, and I would even argue the big energy companies, you know, it's the tax credits around wind and solar, it's tax credits around carbon capture, it's tax credits around hydrogen, and I really don't see any of those going away. You know, the energy companies sent a letter to the president-elect and a number of other folks saying, you know, we support these tax credits and we support this policy. So I really think, though there's going to be small changes at the margin, I think the overall impact, and that's what would drive stock prices, is going to be pretty minimal.
Terrific. Thank you, Jay. All right. Here's another one for you, Jay. Nuclear. There's been some talk about, you know, nuclear. Some nuclear power plants are reopening and they're being rebuilt. There's more talk of using nuclear, especially given your area of expertise, Kevin. AI is consuming, you know, there's so much more energy that's needed to run artificial intelligence. Does nuclear, again, you may not have an answer considering we don't know exactly what the makeup of Congress looks like, but anything to add there?
A ton to add, actually, Anthony. This is one of these things, it's a word we don't often talk about when we talk about Washington politics, but it's bipartisan. That means Democrats and Republicans do something that's really unusual. They agree. but everyone is quite supportive of nuclear right here. You know, I think people, the general public, look at nuclear and they say, wow, a little dangerous. When you look at the history, the track record, very, very safe technology. Yes, we've got the tail end of the fuel cycle. But I think, you know, the Biden administration began this. I would imagine the Trump administration is going to continue this. Try and figure out ways that we can develop more of this. Is that utility scale? Is that small modular reactors? Is that some other innovations around nuclear technology? But it's bipartisan. I would be shocked if that doesn't move forward as well. And again, not that you're less regulation on nuclear plants, which none of us would support from a safety perspective, but less regulation on siting these things and doing that, I think the less regulation helps that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, this gives us a lot of things that we're going to need to be talking about in 2025 and beyond, just with the, you know, the three of us here, four of us at the table, and Brad on Zoom. I think there's a lot that we're going to discover over time, and as we know what happens with Congress, and we'll get a sense of legislation in those first 100 days. So lots going on there. Yeah. I think that was it for questions, and we're getting to the end of our time here. So let me thank you all. Brad, I want to thank you for clicking into us remotely, and thanks, gentlemen, for being here in the studio with me. Always great to get your insights and just, you know, get an honest-to-goodness reaction on what's going on and what our investors and clients and advisors should be thinking about with the market. So thank you, as always.
Thanks,
great, great to see you all. And thank you all for spending some time with us today. And thank you for those of you who did send in your questions. If we didn't get to your question, we will make sure that somebody responds to you within the next couple of hours. So keep looking at your emails there. But on our next monthly live stream that you should be aware of, the last one for this year is going to be Thursday, December 5th. At 1 p.m. Eastern time, so right before the holiday season really kicks into high gear. Until then, we're going to keep you updated, of course, with our latest views through our House View publications, all of our CIO alerts, and more. Plus, we have a lot of great multimedia available. You can check out more videos like our regular series, UBS Trending, and other shows there, as well as our podcasts featuring more colleagues from UBS and our best partners. And as always, we encourage you to continue this conversation with your UBS financial advisor. Thanks for joining us, everybody. From New York City, I'm Anthony Pastore. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investor investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.